So let's take a moment or two and come back to our breath, let our mind settle down and cultivate our motivation. And then we'll begin with chapter 34, which is called Compassionate Thinking and Mentalizing. Mentalizing is a word that somebody, a psychologist, made up. It sounds like one a psychologist would make up. Yeah, like, what in the world does that mean? Well, we'll get to it. Okay, so come back to your breath. So let's pull ourselves out of obsession with what is happening right now and take a bigger look at our situation and the situation of all living beings. Seeing that we are all stuck in cyclic existence, under the force of our ignorance, which gives rise to afflictions, which give rise to polluted actions, or karma, and that the seeds of that polluted karma ripen in terms of our rebirths and our experiences. So if we want to have real freedom, we have to stop the polluted karma. To do that, stop the afflictions. And to do that, totally eradicate ignorance. So we're undertaking this process for the benefit of all living beings, because we're all in the same situation. And so therefore we aspire in the long term for full awakening so that we can do that most effectively. Okay, here we are. So this is Russell's chapter. Yeah, so it is from the perspective of a psychologist. And it's quite interesting. Yeah, so he says, if we're committed to deepening our compassion over time, we'll want to pay attention to our thoughts. As we've discussed before, we all have lots of different thoughts as we go through life. Happy thoughts, sad thoughts, kind thoughts, cruel thoughts, jealous thoughts, and loving thoughts. Boy, we're pretty busy, aren't we? It is best to avoid getting upset and shaming ourselves for having these thoughts. Why? Because shaming ourselves doesn't do any good. It just gets us stuck. At the same time, we know that repeatedly engaging in certain types of thinking creates the habit to think that way in the future, as we're wearing in the mental patterns associated with these types of thinking. So the more we thinking that way, we're setting up that habit, and the more we'll continue with it. And the problem is that we think that way of thinking is correct. You know, the jealous thoughts, the happy thoughts, the critical thoughts, the proud thoughts. We all think that our thoughts are correct. And that's what the problem is. We don't realize how incorrect those thoughts are. Mm-hmm. To develop compassion, we want to choose and nurture the sort of thoughts we wish to have in the future and redirect ourselves when we find we're thinking in ways we don't want to cultivate. Okay, so to catch the unproductive way of thinking, even though we think it's correct, and, you know, do some analysis to see why it's incorrect, and then change it to more beneficial and more realistic ways of thinking. Okay, so this is similar to tending plants we wish to grow in our garden and plucking out the weeds. So that's, I think, why Thich Nhat Hanh talks about watering the seeds in our mind and watering the seeds in other people's minds. So we have to see what we're watering, because what we water will grow. Yeah. One way to understand compassionate thinking is to contrast it with threat-based thinking, the sort of thinking that focuses our minds on ourselves and how best to keep us comfortable in any given moment. Okay, so it's a very self-protective way of thinking. It focuses on me. Remember, the star, the center of the universe, and my happiness, particularly right now. Okay, where self-protective, threat-based thinking sees suffering and attempts to limit our exposure to it by labeling or avoiding it. For example, by explaining it away or blaming it on the person who is suffering. Compassionate thinking considers the other person and seeks to figure out what's really going on in the situation. Okay, so this is talking about a situation where there's some conflict with somebody else, yeah? And so when we get stuck in, this person's criticizing me, and why are they bullying me around, and everybody always does this, and the world isn't fair, that way of thinking, we usually explain it away, yeah? Or we blame it on the other person who is suffering in their own way. Because when there's conflict, believe it or not, we're not the only person suffering in it. Yeah, the other person is suffering too. Yeah. It's interesting how in conflict we never think the other person's suffering, do we? Yeah, we usually just think that they're, just pushing their own way. We don't think, oh, they're doing that because they're unhappy. Okay, so the compassionate way of thinking considers the other person and seeks to figure out what's really going on in the situation. Compassionate thinking often takes the form of asking, what is going on here? What are the causes and conditions that produce this situation, this suffering? How does it make sense that this person is feeling or acting in this way? While threat-based thinking judges and blames, compassionate wisdom seeks to understand suffering, what is happening, why it is happening, and what can be done to help. Okay, so one of the questions that he poses here, yeah, how does it make sense that this person is feeling or acting in that way? Yeah. In other words, what are that person's feelings and what are their needs in the situation, if we put it in nonviolent communication language? Okay. Now, what I've found regarding this is before I ask myself that question, I need to calm my own mind down. Because if I don't, then when I ask that question, you know, how does it make sense that this person is feeling or acting in that way? If my mind isn't calm, then the answer to that question is because they're stupid, because they're self-centered, because they don't want to accept responsibility. In other words, I fall back into criticizing and judging. Okay? So before I can really try and understand the other person's way of thinking, I have to get my own mind calmed down and understand my way of thinking and correct it. Okay? Because if I go immediately to the other person's way of thinking, because we always want to know why, you know, as if that will subdue our own upset and anger in the situation. It doesn't always. Yeah. If I say, why is that person feeling the way they are? Then it's very easy that I start psychologizing about them, you know? And I mean, we all play miniature psychologists. We've read enough self-help books and we've read about, you know, passive aggressive and bipolar and narcissist. Yeah, this is the big ones nowadays. What is this? Narcissist disorder and children who act out, you know, defiant, desire. Yeah, you know, a kid who can't settle down, defiant, oppositional disorder, you know, and we start psychologizing about other people, completely ignoring what's going on in our mind, attributing our diagnostic labels on their suffering. Okay, so I think we have to be very careful here. And I found myself that I really need to calm my own mind first before really getting into understanding where the other person's coming from. It doesn't mean my mind needs to be completely calm, but if I'm very upset, there's no space in my mind to think really about what the other person's feeling or needing. Whereas threat-based thinking is narrow, biased, and tightly focused, compassionate thinking is broad and flexible. It sounds so easy, doesn't it? Yeah? It's threat-based thinking is like that. I don't want that. Compassionate thinking, broad and flexible. I'm broad and flexible. That person just needs to do what I want them to do. Okay? We are able to consider and understand the situation from different perspectives. That's the key, you know, what we have to do. Compassionate thinking can move back and forth between empathizing and problem solving. Although I think at the beginning, empathizing needs to be emphasized. Too often we go to problem solving right away. Okay, and half the time, the problem is that we want to be heard and we want some empathy. So if we emphasize empathy at the beginning, it might solve some of the problem without getting into all of our do this and don't do that. And, you know, you buy the groceries on Monday and I buy them on Tuesday kind of stuff. Okay, compassionate thinking can also move back and forth between directing warmth and acceptance to those who are suffering and seeking pragmatic solutions to address the causes and conditions that create and maintain that suffering. And again, that is done when our mind is open and calmer. Otherwise, we cannot listen to other people. Maybe you people can. I can't. Yeah. And they say, I mean, this is another thing the psychologists say. When you're really upset, there's a period called the refractory period where you cannot take in any new information that disagrees with what you already think. So if we try and understand the other person during the refractory period, we're not going to be able to take any of the information in, okay? Because our mental attention is just like this around, you know, how much I am suffering and what they did to me and how unfair the world is. So some may classify these types of thinking in stereotype gender-based either-or sorts of ways. Women empathize, men problem solve and give advice. True? Not true? I think there's some truth to it, actually. Women are pretty good problem solvers. Huh? Yeah, women are good problem solvers, but in the heat of a conflict, well, yeah, the women don't always empathize. But I think in terms of being people pleasers and taking on responsibility for other people's feelings, I think women are socialized to do that more than men. Yeah. And so that's probably where the stereotype of women empathize comes in, because women feel that they have to, you know, understand everybody and that the responsibility for everybody's happiness relies on them, okay? Whereas, you know, a common complaint among for men is that the women just want to hear and be heard and understood, and the men don't take time to do that. They immediately come in as Mr. Fix-It with their pliers and try and fix the situation, yeah, which isn't always what people want. But these are not hard and fast. I mean, they're stereotypes. They may have some truth, but there's certainly not anything that pigeonholes everybody of a certain gender into a specific role. Yeah. Yeah, I'm on a campaign against people pleasing. Because I can see the problems that happen when people get into people pleasing, you know? And you empathize so much. You're not, well, it looks like you're empathizing, but what you're really doing is scouting out the situation so that you can fix it in your way so that other people will like you and nobody will reject you. Yeah? And that becomes very problematic because then we aren't up front. Yeah, we aren't up front. We're operating under a seemingly compassionate motivation that is actually self-centered. Yeah, and it often gives people mixed messages. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking of battered women. Yeah, battered women often, you know, empathize so much with the man who's beating them that they don't leave because they want to protect him from pain and they feel sorry for him. And, well, he just got angry and he just needs some more TLC. And, you know, and that's not safe for a woman or for kids. Okay. And that just perpetuates the situation. Okay. Okay, so compassionate thinking involves both understanding and action. It balances warm, kind understanding with the need to actively address sources of suffering. Thinking with compassion means being able to discern when swift, assertive action is needed and when it is best to let a situation work itself out without external interference. Okay, so that is not just compassion, that's wisdom. Yeah, we have to have the wisdom in situations and know, when to step back and just let it take its course and when to, actively insert ourselves. And that's not always easy to know. Okay. And here's where our patterns come in. Some people always insert themselves into a conflict situation. Other people always just, empathize with everybody and then, cry and, can't do much. So this is where we have to learn to be flexible and really see, what kind of action on our behalf, from our side, is helpful in any situation. Okay, threat-based thinking, whether it is defensive or competitive in nature, directs hostility towards others and the self. In doing so, it keeps us feeling threatened, fueling negative emotions, and causing us to engage in even more threat-related thoughts and imagery. Right or wrong? Is this how your mind works? You bet. Okay. So they didn't just criticize me today, but this is a pattern that has been going on for months. No, actually years, and probably lifetimes. And that's why I am so messed up. Okay, I mean, we just keep reinvesting in our threat-based thinking. Okay, we reinvest, we collect more interest. Yeah. On the contrary, compassionate thinking is warm, kind, and gently encouraging. Although sometimes it is really straightforward and to the point. Because it has to be. Otherwise, people don't get it. Yeah? So I can see that, sometimes with the way my teachers speak. It's like, it's not warm and fuzzy and, oh, poor disciple, your feelings got hurt. Boo-hoo. It's like, do you want to be a bodhisattva or not? Yeah. One time I went whining to one of my teachers, after she left Dorje Pomo, I was director for a while. And, all these problems and people criticizing me and na-na-na-na-na. So I went to whine to my teacher. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. Yeah, I'm trying to do my best. And he looked at me and he said, people criticize the Buddha too. I stopped whining after that one. Yeah. Okay. So compassionate thinking is focused on building connections between people and can recognize and validate different perspectives. Whereas threat-based thinking focuses on proving ourselves right to avoid feeling vulnerable or embarrassed. Who does that besides me? I'm a proponent of this. That's my strategy. Okay, compassionate thinking seeks to understand the wisdom that lies behind others' perspectives. But others' perspectives are always so silly and stupid. Yeah? I mean, I'm right, and they just better get it after all. Oh, I'm glad you finally agree with me. You've been so oppositional and defiant. Okay. Compassionate thinking recognizes that appreciating diversity and differences doesn't threaten our own convictions. And when it seems to, maybe it's because our convictions could use some reexamination. Really? Do you think your convictions need reexamination? Of course not. You know? First of all, I don't even know I have opinions and convictions because it's just what's right. That's all. They're not opinions and ideas and convictions. It's what's right in the world. And how can you re-examine what's right in the world? Anybody, people think like that? Any of you think like that? Yeah. In other words, compassion is like a cool jug of water quenching the fire of negativity. I think we need more than one cool jug of water. Yeah. How about planes with fire retardant and hoses? And I'm thinking all these states, especially California, suffers from water shortage. And how do you put out fires in a state that suffers from water shortage? We see this in the way the Dalai Lama discusses religion. We might expect that as a spiritual leader, he would try to promote his religion and elevate it above other religions. That's not His Holiness. However, he avoids doing this, knowing that to do so would alienate many people, and his goal is to contribute to the spiritual well-being of all beings. And also because I think he sincerely believes that depending on a person's disposition at any particular time, another religion may be the most beneficial thing for that person. Yeah. So I think it's just, you know, he doesn't want to, it's not just not wanting to offend people. But I think this is what he sincerely believes and wants people to find a spiritual tradition that speaks to their heart in a way that they will keep good ethical conduct and develop kindness towards others. Yeah, because those values are not religious and they're the foundation of human happiness. In fact, recognizing and respecting that different people are more or less suited to different spiritual approaches, he discourages Buddhists from proselytizing. Instead, he encourages people to follow the path that works best for them in building happy lives and balances giving very scholarly Buddhist teachings to appropriate audiences with doing Buddhist talks and writing books that speak directly to topics of concern to people of all faiths and of no faith. So his books, The World in a Single Atom, The Ethics for a New Millennium, all these kind of books written very much for a secular audience. To him, secular means including all religions. That's what it means in India, okay? Here, secular tends to be apart from religion, okay? He similarly speaks of science in an open-minded way, even going so far as to say that if science disproves some aspect of Buddhism, Buddhism must change. This is the perspective of compassionate thinking. Moved by suffering and the desire to address it, we seek to understand and help, to grow and improve, even when it may mean being vulnerable, and even when it means we may need to change. In embracing compassion, we need to surrender our desire to prove ourselves right. Surrender our desire to prove ourselves right. Okay. So what I find so interesting is religions, all religions across the board, talk about ethical conduct, love, kindness, compassion, helping the poor and needy. All the religions talk about this, okay? Being tolerant, being inclusive. The doctrine is like that. The religious institutions, not so. And some of the people who are most religious or have conviction in the tradition often are not so open-minded and accepting and tolerant and compassionate to others. It's very interesting, isn't it? You know, and it shows in that Sunday morning in America is the most segregated time in the country. Yeah, that's when everybody is with the people who look like and think like them. Yeah, it's really somehow, you know, there's really a gap between what imperfect human beings teach when we teach the teachings of the awakened beings and, you know, what people actually do. Yeah. So it's people that need to change, but institutions that need to change too. And very often what happens is we have invested so much in building an institution and we confuse the institution with the teachings and with the principles that so inspire us that then we defend the institution even when the institution is causing harm or being bigoted or whatever. Yeah, it's, you know, this is one thing from my study of history is you see, you know, what are the most conservative, less willing to change institutions in society? Usually religious ones. And they're the ones that talk the most about loving kindness, compassion, equality, treating people right, being honest. Yeah, we human beings are so interesting. How does this happen? Yeah. When working to address the psychological source of suffering in others or ourselves, compassionate thinking can take the form of mentalizing. So there's a footnote, thank goodness, about this. Okay, so this is chapter, 34? Let's see. The concept of mentalizing was introduced by British psychologist Peter Fonagy, with his articles and the how you can find his articles, the bibliography of his articles, but doesn't define it. Okay, we'll see. Mentalizing involves considering the mental causes that are at the heart of our and others' behavior. We inadvertently bring much of our suffering on ourselves by engaging in the very actions that lead to our own suffering. Isn't that true? We shoot ourselves in the foot all the time. Okay, as we've discussed, when we see ourselves or other people doing this, we can easily become critical, blaming, or shaming. In contrast with mentalizing, we consider that our actions have causes that originate in our minds based in our perceptions, interpretations, motives, desires, needs, beliefs, and previous experiences. In Buddhist languages, this means that we reflect on causes and conditions. Okay? As with other forms of compassionate thinking, mentalizing often takes the form of asking questions. What might be going on in this person's mind that influences them to act in this way? What need is this person trying to meet? What does their behavior tell me about how they may be perceiving or interpreting this situation? Often, when we are able to slow down, stop the negative labeling, and understand what is going on in another person's mind, their behavior makes sense, even if we do not fully agree with their approach. Okay. But the mentalizing is asking ourselves why this other person's doing what they're doing and what their needs or concerns are. How about going and asking them? Instead of psychologizing, how about going and asking them, you know, what are you feeling for the, you know, in this conflict or in this situation, what is it that is really important to you? Yeah, because sometimes, you know, we can go round and around in circles trying to answer these questions when it's actually much easier to go and ask the person. And then that person probably will feel like, oh, we're beginning to get it, you know, and we are interested in them, and then we can offer some empathy. Yeah. So sometimes it's good just go and ask the other person. Because I know for me, sometimes it took so long for me to understand what a conflict was about. Okay, so take a conflict of a teenager with their parents. Okay, anybody had that conflict? Yeah? Okay, so my version, my conflict was I had to be home, it seemed like earlier than all my friends did. And if I couldn't be home on time, I had to call. Because, and I'm not exaggerating, if it was 1 minute after my curfew time and I wasn't home, my mother was a worrier. And she would be, you know, and she threatened this, and I knew she would do it. She would be on the phone with the police. My daughter's been kidnapped. She's been in a car accident. You know, she would be hysterical. The police officers would be going, ay vey, you know. And I would be sitting out somewhere with my boyfriend, you know, without a phone because they didn't have phones to call your mother in those days. Okay, so for me, the conflict with my parents was about my autonomy. You know, I was an adult now, and I can make wise decisions, you know, and I wanted to decide, you know, what I wanted to do. And no, I wouldn't stay out until 3, but at least, you know, don't call the police at 1 minute after 12. And, you know, have some confidence and, you know, let me do what I want. But I didn't say it that way. Okay. And I couldn't figure out, you know, to me, the conflict looked like my parents are just overprotective. Yeah. They worry too much and they're overprotective and it drives me crazy. Okay. Now, it took me, I would say, a good at least 10 years, if not more, to understand what the conflict was like from my parents' viewpoint. What was it like from their viewpoint? What were they concerned with? My safety. Yeah? They just wanted their daughter to be safe. That was the farthest thing from my mind in thinking what the conflict is about from their viewpoint. Because to me, it was about control and autonomy, and they wanted to control me. Yeah. And the excuse was so I didn't get kidnapped or in a car accident or pregnant or something like that, you know? So, but, you know, it never dawned on me that that was what it was about for them. Yeah. So it would have been interesting, you know. In those days, people didn't go to counselors very much, you know, at least not in my family. Yeah, because we didn't have problems. Other people's families went to counselors, you know, but we didn't. In spite of this one not talking to that one and that one not talking to this one. But yeah. Okay. But, you know, if somebody just could have pointed that out to both of us, you know, because they thought, oh, they didn't think, oh, she wants to be autonomous, that it's about, the conflict is about autonomy and control. They thought, we have this stupid teenage daughter who doesn't know how to keep herself safe. Yeah. So we were like, with each other. Yeah. And so a conversation, if it could have happened, could have easily resolved that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Mentalizing can be a gateway to compassion. When we see that hostile racism, sexism, or political hatred are based on misperceptions, for example, that people different from oneself will take away all the jobs for people like me, yeah, we can understand that this hostility is based on fear and insecurity. We'll know that to overcome it, we need to find a way to help this person feel safe. Yeah. And to give them equal opportunity is probably the best way for them to feel safe. Rather than labeling this person as a selfish idiot or a radical leftist, we can see that he or she is suffering and recognize that when the suffering is addressed, the hatred will abate. But it's not only radical leftist, it's also labeling the people as radical alt-right. Yeah. And, you know, these people from the religious right, what are they thinking? And these Marxists from the radical left, what are they thinking? And, you know, nobody can understand anybody else. In short, once we understand what is going on in another person's mind that is creating their suffering, we're better equipped to help them. Yeah, both sides are just saying, I feel scared in a changing society. Yeah? I feel scared in a changing society. I'm not sure who I am, where I belong, if I'm going to have equal access to opportunities. Yeah. We can also apply mentalizing to ourselves, observing that we're doing something that is creating problems in our lives. Really? We do things that create problems in our lives? I thought it was only other people who did that to us. Yeah. Do you do things that create problems in your life? Really? Okay. So if we're observing that we're doing something that is creating problems in our lives, we can look more closely at it. How am I interpreting this situation? What need or desire is being served by this behavior? None. Besides giving me time to pout and whine and blame the world. Once we understand the mental causes behind our actions, we can ask ourselves, how could I work to address this need in a way that is more productive? What resources can I access that will help me do this? Is this belief of mine really true? That's the big one. To really check our thoughts and beliefs, and is this really true? And our expectations. Yeah. So here's the reflection. In this exercise, we'll use compassionate thinking to consider the mental causes that may be behind another person's emotion and behavior. I would like to suggest that first, we apply these questions to understand our own emotions and behavior. Okay? And then follow that by thinking about it in terms of other understanding other people's emotions and behavior. Okay? Yeah, because he said, once we understand the mental causes behind our actions, so first understanding that, then ask ourselves, how can I work to address the need in a way that is more productive? In other words, work on ourselves. What accesses, resources can I access to change my own mind? And then use the compassionate thinking in this reflection to think about another person's situation. Okay, but first ourselves. So bring to mind a person who you'd like to understand better. Me, I volunteer. I'll be the person you can try and understand better as long as you understand all the good things about me and how I only mean well. Okay, consider a situation in which you've observed them struggling. Ask questions to help you better understand their perspective. Okay, so how are they making sense of this situation? Okay, first you ask that. But you see, this is why you have to do it for yourself first, yeah? Okay, but for others, how are they making sense of this situation? What needs are they trying to meet with this behavior? Do they perceive a threat? If so, what sort? Physical harm, being rejected by others, threats to status, reputation, or material comfort? How might their previous conditioning or background be impacting them? Okay, so you think about that. Then once you've done this, engage in compassionate thinking about what would be helpful to them. What would help them to feel safe? How can I best help them to meet their needs and develop their own strengths? And you see, this is why you have to do it for yourself first and calm down. Otherwise, the answer to how can I best help them to meet their needs and develop their strengths is give them my advice about how I think they should be and insist that they follow it. Okay. Oh, that's the end of the chapter. Okay. So, I think you can do some of that reflection in the discussion period this afternoon. Okay, for yourself, then for others, and see what comes from it. In the meantime, we have some time for questions, comments.
I was thinking about what you were talking about at the beginning about empathy and what was the other thing, being more, I guess, problem solvers or something, men being problem solvers or whatever, and mm-hmm. women being more mm-hmm. empathetic. And then what you talked about right after that, and I kind of, when I moved here, I was a people pleaser, and you taught me about that. And so I recognize better what that is. But I wouldn't say that being a people pleaser has much to do with being empathetic, because in my own experience, I'm still learning that skill, and they, for inside of me, they feel like they're worlds apart. In fact, yeah. if anything, I think they're maybe unrelated.
Yeah, that's why I said that often with a people pleaser, the empathy isn't real empathy. It's so that the other person will calm down and will like us and think that we're kind. Yeah. It's not really trying to understand them. Yeah.
I think it's amazing the similarities between this threat-based thinking and the self-centered attitude. I think you could just switch out that term.
And, yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah. Well, the threat-based thinking is totally self-centered. Yeah. And thinking of how what's threatening us, our happiness, what's interfering with us getting what we want. Yeah. And so you can see this is what is happening in the country now, is, you know, with the election coming up, this whole thing of making people more and more afraid. Yeah. Getting the whole public into threat-based thinking. You know, if this one's elected, oh, you know, and if that one's elected, then oh. And then everybody just gets like this. It's like, oh, I'm so threatened. My whole world's going to collapse unless my candidate gets elected because the other guy is out to Mars, you know. And is going to destroy the country. Yeah. It's quite interesting what the two sides are accusing each other of. Yeah. The accusations are quite similar. Yeah. And the whole side, of course, one side, not my side, the other side, is doing more of the fear-based stuff. My side's doing more of the empathizing because I believe in empathy. The other side, oh boy. But you guys agree with me, so what I think must be right. So, yeah, it's like fear is being used as a political strategy. And fear works very well. It works very well. You get people scared, and then you can manipulate them very easily, even though what they really need to be afraid of is the person who's making the accusations and telling them that everything is dire and the world's going to collapse. Yeah. I mean, this is the playbook of dictators and autocrats throughout history. Yeah. And nothing new here. But as a public, you know, this is where our self-centeredness comes in. It's like, oh, I'm threatened. And now it's not just a personal threat by, you know, the neighbor's dog. It's, you know, the whole other half of the country. Yeah. And not just the country. It's the world, you know, the other country who deliberately sent the coronavirus to us to ruin our country, you know? Yeah. So, but it works. And so this is why, you know, we have to be very, very astute and really check what people say and check what we ourselves say and check what we ourselves believe to see if, you know, to what extent we and other people are perpetrating this fear-based way of seeing the world.
A few questions are coming online. Someone is asking, I just want to make sure I understand what mentalizing means. Does it mean that we are trying to understand what's going on in another person's mind?
That's what it seems to me that it means, but I am not a psychologist. But that's what I got. Is that what you got from the description? Yeah.
And someone else is asking, any advice for when you ask someone what they feel or need, and they just tell you you're being patronizing and continue to feel hurt and angry?
You ask them what they feel and think, and they're patronizing towards you.
No, they tell you that you're being patronizing by asking, and then they continue to feel hurt and angry.
Yeah, well, what do you do? Anybody have any brilliant ideas that will instantly change the situation?
Yes.
Huh?
You
do use death? Oh.
Guesses. Death. From the NVC point of view, you don't ask them directly, what are you feeling? Right? Or even kindly, but you guess.
Oh.
You guess.
You
guess. Are you feeling sad because you need blah, blah, blah? Are you feeling sad and just stop there for a minute to check if they're even going to accept that? But you come at it gently. But also, this is my biggest problem with NVC that I will share with others. NVC exists. NVC is only created in order for the person to connect. So if my motivation is anything other than to connect, then I am being patronizing, honestly. If I'm trying to just figure it out so I can solve the problem, if I'm trying to figure it out so I can fix it, if I'm trying to ask them what they're feeling and needing so I don't feel uncomfortable or that they'll chill out, or they'll do what I want them to do, all the other reasons that we communicate, then it is a problem. So we have to check ourselves personally what really is moving us to guess what they're feeling and needing. So...
Because,
and it's hard.
Yeah. Because what you're saying is maybe we are being patronizing. Yeah. And especially, you know, there are some people who grew up in families that did not talk about feelings to the extent that they don't even know how to label what they're feeling. Or there's people who feel uncomfortable talking about feelings for whatever reason. So if you just come on with, well, what are you feeling and what do you need, that person, you know, freezes. So, you know, maybe the best thing, if they say you're being patronizing and they feel hurt and they say, leave me alone, maybe we should do what they ask us to do. Yeah? And... see what our real motivation is for asking.
Someone else asks, if you want to understand others and their suffering, the other day you said that someone who wants to end their life is somehow selfish, not thinking how others will feel afterwards. But it doesn't seem compassionate to ask others who suffer unbearable suffering to live for others, or to live because suicide causes a bad rebirth? I guess the question's kind of in...
Yeah, somebody asked that question after the teaching Friday night, too. If a person wants to suicide, you're not asking them to live for others and endure their own suffering, because otherwise it's selfish and they're hurting other people. You're not going to that person and saying that to them and asking them to do that. They have enough problems already. Okay? So in saying that suicide is a tragedy, you know, we're not saying that the person who is wanting to suicide is bad and horrible and, you know, look what they're doing and they shouldn't do that. They should be more considerate of other people. We're not doing a trip on them. Okay? Yeah. We're just looking and saying what a sad situation this is, that the person can't see the value that they do have in their life. Okay? I mean, it's just because it is sad that they can't see that. We're not saying, you know, you should really see that your life is valuable. And don't you dare think of suicide. That's so selfish. You've done that your whole life. Just cut it out, you know. Listen to me and follow my advice. Come on. Yeah, that's not what's going to help somebody who is despondent like that. Okay? So I think this is a thing that people often misunderstand when suicide survivors talk. Yeah? Because the suicide survivors, in other words, the family that has and friends that have dealt with it, they have their feelings and needs too. Yeah, and the person who suicides has their feelings and needs too. And it's not a thing of pointing fingers at one side or the other and telling them that they're wrong and they're bad. Yeah, that's not what is going on here. Okay. Yeah.
So earlier you said, you pointed out how we don't even know that we have convictions and opinions. We just think they're facts and we're right. So can you recommend any ways that we can challenge these convictions that we have? Because, yeah, you're totally right. We don't, we think they're infallible. And
Go live in other countries or in our country, make friends with people from different ethnic, religious, socioeconomic classes, you know. When you live with people who have had different experiences, yeah, than you were raised with, then you see very clearly some of your assumptions that you didn't realize you had. Yeah. Like, I was raised, you know, like most kids in the U.S., democracy is the best way. Every country should be democratic, and we should make them democratic ASAP, because that will solve the problems with their autocratic leadership. Okay? So we want to make the world safe for democracy and spread democracy. Okay? Then I went to live in the Tibetan community, which is a very interesting community. These were in the days before the Dalai Lama resigned as the political head of the Tibetan people. And that community at that time, it was very interesting, the only one I know of, where the leader could have more power but wanted less power, and the followers wanted their leader to have more power. Where the leader wanted to resign and make them more democratic, and the people themselves did not want democracy. Yeah. And it was shocking to me, you know? And then I saw how different problems were dealt with in the community and in monasteries. And it was like, wow, these people think really different than I do. And maybe democracy is not the right way for every single group of people, especially American-style democracy, which actually is not so democratic if you consider the Electoral College and the lack, you know, impeding people's right to vote and so on and so forth. Okay? So it really made me step back and think, oh, you know, different cultures have different ways of thinking. Yeah? And you can't just barge in with the American foreign policy and say now everybody's going to be democratic when the people have no idea what it is and they don't necessarily want it. Yeah? So that's just an example. Yeah? But other ways living in the Tibetan community. When I heard some people, they were talking about the Chinese occupation of Tibet and the conflict between China and Tibet. And I remember one person said to me, you know, the devas from China and the devas, celestial beings, spirits from China and the spirits from Tibet are quarreling, and that's why the people are quarreling. And it's like, I never learned that in high school history class. You know? But for them, that was as real as anything I learned in high school history as a reason for conflict. Yeah? And how do you make some political, very important political decisions? You do a mo, you do a doughball mo. You put answers in little pieces of dough and you whirl them around and see which one flies out of the vessel. Or you have a medium go into trance and they'll tell you. Okay? And, you know, we could go in there as white colonizing people saying, we are the modern ways of thinking. You people, you know, what you think and do is really rather stupid, you know, because we are the supreme culture. Yeah. But first of all, are we so sure? Are we so sure? If that way of making decisions works for those people? Yeah. To us, we may say, what? You're making decisions on political decisions about war based on that? Well, we invaded Iraq based on U.S. intelligence that was totally wrong. You know? So it makes you stop and wonder, you know, if something works for a certain culture, who am I to say?
Another question or just a comment?
One more.
Okay. Someone asks, often when I'm angry, I shut down and then go cry. I am trying to see how this might be related to the threat-based thinking. How can I better understand what's fueling my actions and apply compassionate thinking?
Okay. Oh, another person who shut down and cries. I feel understood. Anybody else feel understood? I know a few of you do. There's a few people around here who shut down and cry. Yes, it's definitely threat-based thinking, isn't it? Yeah, it's really, it's, you know, And it's a kind of thinking that you're not really even sure what the threat is, except somebody is loud and they're throwing things or they're shouting or they're dissing me, and I have no real idea about why I'm actually feeling afraid, except there's this loud, violent-seeming energy coming towards me. Does that the way, yeah? All the people who shut down and cry, yeah? Do you really understand the issue and what's going on at that time? Do you even know what you feel threatened about? What do you feel threatened about? Do you think they're going to kick you out of the house? Do you think that they're going to, you know, write bad things about you and put it in the newspaper? Do you think that they're going to, you know, slap you? Do you, you know, what is it that we feel is the concrete threat? And I know for myself, often I haven't even gotten that far. I'm just reacting to the tone of voice, the volume of the voice, and the body language. And that's enough to make me shut down. Huh? What do other people think? What happens with you?
Sometimes I notice that the fear is that I won't be able to respond appropriately, that I won't be able to control my own negative emotions.
Ah.
And so then I shut down rather than risk that.
So fear of your own anger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that could definitely be in there. Yeah.
I think I shut down when things go unexpectedly and then I start to panic. I don't know what to do here. I don't know what to say. I just start to feel like I'm losing control and the ego starts to just tighten up and seize because a lack of knowing and then fear of making it worse or.
Yeah. Thing. So it's lack of control and the feeling of insecurity that you have no specific notion of what bad thing is going to happen, but you just feel insecure. Yeah, and unsafe. Even though you're not even certain what you feel insecure or unsafe about.
And I tell myself, I'm wrong. Something's going wrong. I'm wrong. I've done something wrong.
Oh, yeah. This is another big one, isn't it? If they're unhappy and yelling and screaming, I did something wrong. Enter people pleasing. Yeah. So, yes, sometimes we may have made a mistake, okay, and we need to own that. But immediately going to, I'm wrong, I'm bad, I disappointed them, what's wrong with me? That is going to, I take responsibility for everybody's feelings. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that when it's like that, the mind is overwhelmed and you actually can't think, you know. So
yeah.
I think it's helpful just to recognize, wow, my mind is overwhelmed now and get myself back together before I try to do anything.
Yeah.
Which is why, like Venerable Seppel, I'm always scared of my anger too, and I will just remove myself before I cause some fires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just realizing, you know, my mind is out of control right now, and I need to remove myself from the situation and calm down. And then go back and say, now we can talk. Yeah.